Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Featuring Joe Sweeney from Thinking Sideways podcast and filmmaker Vincent Caldoni. This is The Shocking Details.
Intro us in when you're ready, Joe.
Hey there. Welcome to another episode of The Shocking Details. I'm Joe, joined by Vincent Caldoni, as usual. Say hi, Vince.
Hey, what's up?
Yeah. And this week we're going to continue talking a little bit about D.B. Cooper because, we're only several days past the 50th anniversary of his reimagining of the Flight 305. As you know, some people call it a hijacking. I don't know. That seems kind of judgmental to me. Don't you think?
I think it's hijacking.
Okay, fine. I like reimagining better. But we're going to talk a little bit about, we told the story, we're going to talk a little bit about some of the theories, some of the obsessions and thoughts of many of the people in the Cooper world that have popped up over the years as people have scratched their heads over this one. And the D.B. Cooper story contains a lot of little and large sub-mysteries. Mm-hmm, wouldn't you agree?
Sure.
Yeah, there are definitely some little head-scratchers in here. Anyway, so let's get into this. First, do you have a favorite little sub-mystery, little mystery within the mystery, Vincent, that you'd like to talk about?
No, but I would like to say the thing actually I learned most recently is it actually happened. I learned this the day of the 50th anniversary. I was never clear where D.B. Cooper and Dan Cooper came from. And we still don't know who it is, but the man who hijacked the airplane and jumped out of it, he never said he was D.B. Cooper. He said he was Dan Cooper.
He did.
I didn't know that he had never told anybody in any way or written on anything that he was D.B. Cooper.
Nope, he never did. He never did. That was just a little screw up, apparently a miscommunication between the police and the press. Apparently, there was some reporter overheard a policeman talking to another policeman or talking on the phone about a suspect who was local, who lived in Oregon, who had a record, and his name was D.B. Cooper. And so that was one of the first things they wanted to do was check out this D.B. Cooper dude, you know. And that is the story that I've heard about how this misunderstanding occurred.
Yeah, I always wondered about it, but I just always assumed there was something somewhere that tied the name DB to, because I know that when he signed on, he gave his name to the ticket agent in Portland.
Yeah.
He said his name was Dan Cooper.
Yeah, he did. Yeah.
But I always figured he wrote DB on something or somebody knew it was DB or he told someone it was DB. Nope. It seems to just come from this one man from the Dalles.
Briefly
looked into and dismissed, but because of a miscommunication with the press, the name DB Cooper has stuck, which is fascinating.
Well, it's actually, and it makes sense, too, because DB is a little catchier than Dan, don't you think?
Dan Cooper's anonymous. Yeah. It's an anonymous name. It's so anonymous.
Yeah, it's very generic, whereas DB sounds kind of cool, you know?
Yeah, I mean, that sounds like it could be an author or a skyjacker.
A skyjacker, a loan shark, a criminal of some sort. Yeah, I don't know, whatever. But anyway, so there it is, Dan. It's Dan became DB. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. So, let's see what else.
Let's talk about one of your favorite subjects.
What's that?
Butts.
The butts. I love butts. I love a good butt. Yeah, hell yeah. The butts. We mentioned this.
Joe likes good butt conspiracies, and he cannot lie.
I cannot. Yeah. So this we mentioned this briefly last week.
We did actually. We talked about it kind of at length. So we'll go through it quick.
Yeah. So Cooper left 8 cigarette butts on the plane. 8 cigarette butts. Yeah. And Raleigh cigarettes. And it's not really a lot because he was on the plane for quite a while.
Well, it's not a lot for a smoker. It's a lot of evidence to work with.
Oh, it is. Yeah, definitely. But unfortunately, they're gone. And so I don't know. I'm not a conspiracy theorist, you know, except when I am, but it is odd that they disappeared the way they did because, especially given the fact that they could conceivably be really, really helpful today with, you know, DNA evidence, et cetera, in identifying Cooper.
What year did they go missing, Joe?
Well, I don't really know. We don't really know exactly what year. I mean, when we were at KuperCon, there was a little bit of discussion about the butts, actually. And Eric Ulis, who's done a lot of research into Cooper and who actually organized KuperCon, he said that he had actually seen an FBI report saying that the cigarette butts had been examined and had no further evidentiary value and were destroyed. Said he saw this. We also had that chat, as you were there, but with Bruce Smith, author, who said he saw a report saying that the cigarettes could be disposed of, but he didn't see anything definitively saying they actually had been destroyed or pitched or whatever. He hadn't seen that.
Yeah.
So
I guess what I ask about the year is that I'd be willing to entertain notions of a conspiracy theory.
Exactly.
If the year that they were lost was at a time when DNA was really prevalent, right?
Mm-hmm. Like, that's the big question. Although,
right. Like if the memo is from just after OJ, you'd be like, crap, people are figuring this DNA thing out. We need to throw it out.
Yeah.
Or if the memo was written, you know, the day they caught the Golden State Killer, be like, we need to get this out of here. Then I can see a conspiracy. But if they were just we looked over these stupid cigarette butts up and down, we didn't get fingerprints. There were no traces of saliva that we could do anything with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, couldn't even get a blood type.
Stinky old cigarette butts, throw them out.
Yeah.
Well,
I get your point there, but there is such a thing as forging and backdating memos. So
that's true.
I'm assuming these memos that they saw were from before the era of DNA, but that doesn't mean they weren't fake. Now, yeah. And again, before I get too far down into this, I mean, I'm not inclined to believe there was a conspiracy, but at the same time, you would think they would have just put back into the evidence with everything else, because it's really odd when you consider the huge quantities of Cooper evidence that the FBI did not throw away or destroy. Like, for example, the reserve parachute that we'll be talking about a little later that they found on the plane that he had opened up and cannibalized. And they still got that, or at least maybe the National Archives has it now. I don't know. But they still have his tie. They still have his ticket stub. They still have all kinds of stuff. But they just couldn't find any space for 8 cigarette butts. I mean, really?
Although, we shouldn't talk about this. My pushback on that would be that actually, if you were to talk about cases that weren't as important as D.B. Cooper, small, potentially inconsequential evidence like that does go missing.
Oh, it does. It does.
Even when you're talking about highly professional organizations like the FBI. So, it does happen.
It does. And actually, the other thing, too, is probably if you're going to get rid of them, probably would have made more sense to go out and find some Raleigh cigarettes and light them and burn them down to the nubs and then swap them in for the original ones. You know, you could do that too.
Point.
So yeah, I think it was a screw up rather than a conspiracy. Personally,
I think so too. I think it doesn't tell us about a conspiracy about keeping Cooper's secret identity a secret. I think it tells us that by a certain point, the FBI was getting lax because they were so committed to the narrative that D.B. Cooper jumped out of the plane and was just dead out there.
Could have been that valley
or whatever.
I have an alternative theory as well, is that the FBI did not destroy them, but that somebody at the FBI took them as souvenirs and probably epoxied them into an ashtray and has the ashtray glued to his wall, even as we speak, you know.
Weird these are.
That's what I think. Some pretty lame souvenirs, but what the hell? Yeah, those are E.B. Cooper's cigarette butts.
I hope somebody's got, a search alert up on eBay for those.
Oh, that's a good point. Yeah, that didn't even occur to me. Yeah, are the butts on eBay? Ooh.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Okay, so much for the butts.
Yeah, let's move on from the butts. It's kind of, we kind of chewed that one to death.
Yeah.
I am interested in this one because I've never totally understood this one, which is Cooper as foreigner.
Yeah, Cooper, some people suspected that he was a foreigner. Yeah, which is, Flo and—
okay, so we're clear, the people who suspected he was a foreigner are none of the people he met.
Yeah,
spoke with
Flo and Tina, the two flight attendants, did not mention anything like weird mannerisms or accent or anything like that.
The FBI specifically asked, at least Tina, I know I've seen this, and I'm sure they did Flo too. They asked Tina Mucklow so many times about to describe his voice, describe his accent, and she was kind of at a loss. If you look at any of those transcripts, she's at a total loss to even figure out where he might be from.
Mm-hmm.
was he rural? Was he urban? I forget the questions they ask her, but like they ask her over and over. And she's like, he just kind of had a normal average voice.
Yeah. Just your normal average Midwestern twangy kind of, you know, American. Yeah. So it didn't have an outrageous Southern accent or New England accent or anything like that.
A foreign accent. He didn't have like a Spanish accent or
nothing. You know. But the reason this thing got started is that in his demand for ransom, he specified $200,000, denominations unimportant,
which is interesting.
Yeah, in negotiable American currency. And so some people thought at least that phrase, negotiable American currency, was a little odd and something that a phrase that an American would not use. And
I agree with them. That's a weird way to talk about that.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
I would also, I mean, maybe he knew that the banks couldn't do it. I would also want the biggest bill that they could feasibly get their hands on.
To make it a little easier to carry.
Right.
$100
bills weigh, if you're planning to jump out of an airplane, probably should know that $200,000 worth of 20s weighs five times more than hundreds.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, that's true. Although, you know, obviously they'd be easier to pass, unnoticed.
That is true.
The foreigner theory was given a little bit of a boost fairly recently when somebody made this connection there between Cooper and this French Canadian comic book series about a fictional guy named Dan Cooper.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Who is a parachuter in the comics, right?
He was a test pilot in the Royal Canadian Air Force and also, you know, an expert parachutist and skydiver and all this other stuff and lots of derring do. I mean, all sorts of, you know, foreign spies and aliens and all kinds of cool stuff. I never read the comics. They're in French. But that is really
interesting. That is, I mean, because I don't think I know Americans who are hardcore comic nerds and they've never heard of the Dan Cooper comics.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and they know, they can tell you, they can cite chapter and verse, you know, Donald Duck comics from this period.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Dan Cooper is not something they know because it's French. It's French Canadian also, right? It's not even French.
Yeah,
it's Canadian.
Yeah, well, the character was at least French Canadian. I mean, I heard that the comics actually came out in Europe. They were they're French Belgium, set in Canada, or actually, he was a Canadian test pilot. Doesn't mean that all the action took place in Canada.
But he was a Canadian character.
Yeah, but anyway, so that gave that theory a little bit of legs. But other than that, I mean, my theory about why he said what he said was just it was a reference to the Lindbergh kidnapping, when the Lindbergh baby was kidnapped. This was in 1932. That would have been, given Cooper's age, that would have been something that he grew up with, just like you and I grew up with D.B. Cooper.
Sure.
And a well-known case, and their ransom demands were $50,000, and they wanted very specific in denominations, $25,000 in 20s, $15,000 in 10s, and $10,000 in 5s.
So totally different.
Yeah, and as the sneaky feds, when they put together the ransom, they put in a bunch of gold certificates, which were about to be a lot of dollars back in the day. Used to say gold certificate right along the top of them, and that this dollar or 10 or whatever represented a claim on a specific. Right. But a specific amount of gold in Fort Knox. And so they were called gold certificates, but they were about to be withdrawn from circulation like the next week or something. And so that's how they actually wound up catching the kidnappers.
Right.
And so if you look at Cooper's demands, they're actually a mirror image of the Lindbergh kidnapping ransom note. Because he says, you know, denominations aren't important, but very specifically says negotiable American currency. So I don't think that's really that bizarre of a demand, because again, it's like, you know, they pulled a fast one on the Lindbergh kidnappers, and he was basically saying, hey, you know, no fast ones, no gold certificates, nothing like that. Yeah. So anyway,
they kind of did anyway, because those, you know, the serial numbers, but yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
All right,
And interestingly enough, it was a while, not too long ago, I stumbled across something on the FBI's website, which was an account of the abduction of George Weyerhaeuser.
Okay.
And
I've heard about this. I don't know a lot about it, but I know he got it. abducted in the 30s and was ransomed, right?
Yeah, he was abducted in 1935. He was 9 years old. He was the heir to the Weyerhaeuser fortune. We're talking Weyerhaeuser Lumber Paper Company, those guys.
Huge landowners in addition to being, you know, industrialists who make paper and wood products.
Yeah, and so he was abducted in 1935. And his he lived, by the way, in Tacoma. And his ransom demand was $200,000, and so that makes me this is just as silly as was Cooper a foreigner. And this is my thought: is like, was Cooper a true crime aficionado? Was, you know, because you could look at his ransom demands as kind of references to two huge kidnapping stories of children.
Yeah.
I mean, that's why they and so. Even though I think that it's probably purely random as far as the Weyerhaeuser thing goes, you know, you could look at it that way. I mean,
it's an interesting idea, though.
Well, it's not something I would spend a lot of time on, but keep it in the back of your mind.
I'm interested in the Quebecois connection because one of the things I will say, and this is not that I think this is the case, but I have known a couple of French Canadians who grew up in bilingual households and who could speak English with an accent. You would, if you talked to them long enough, start to hear that French accent creep in. But that if you were having short interactions on an airplane, for example, you would think that they spoke with, you'd have a hard time placing their accent, right? So not only is it completely perfect, 100% absolutely totally fluent English, but it also doesn't have, it doesn't sound Canadian. Like they don't sound like they're from Ottawa. It doesn't, it just kind of is English. I don't know. I don't know how to describe it.
Yeah.
So that plus the olive complexion.
Maybe.
Cooper. I don't know.
I don't know either. The thing about it is, of course, is that, like, you know, even if he is, say, French Canadian or foreign from somewhere, it doesn't really move us too far down the road towards solving the mystery of who the hell he was.
We have not narrowed it down very. I mean,
that doesn't, yeah, it doesn't help us very much. Yeah, there are. So, anyway, was he a foreigner? I don't think he was. Like I said,
I'm not inclined to think that either. But I will say I'm a little more interested after this talk. I'm interested in the French Canada connection.
Go
to Montreal and check it out.
Well, yeah, let's do it. I think it's timely. We got to take this show on the road. Let's go to Quebec.
They've got better milk than us and
really?
Have to drink it out of a bag.
Oh, really? Okay.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I want to see that. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, okay. Right, so let's put aside the was Cooper a foreigner bit here. What's our next little mini mystery here?
Well, so this is, I want you to really run this one for me, Joe, because this is kind of one of the deep dives you've done on it. But one of the questions is, so one of the things that happened that has led to so many questions is Cooper sort of cannibalized a reserve chute.
Yeah.
Right. So he had this one reserve chute that he, I guess, felt he didn't need. And he took parts off of it, did something with it, cut it all apart.
Yeah. He opened it up and pulled the canopy out of the container. That's the little backpacky thing, that, you know, pulled it all the way out. Yeah. Oh, go ahead. Yeah.
Oh, no. Yeah. I think you should take it. Yeah. I mean, basically, he did this and we don't know why. So why don't you tell everybody what he did and what you think he might have been trying to do with it?
Yeah. Well, okay. So, He actually did take some parachute cord out of this which was gone. So obviously he used a couple of pieces to tie his bag shut and wrap it all up tightly so it wouldn't come open on descent and to tie it to his body. But anyway, still, there's an odd thing about how he went about this. Okay, because he pulled the whole thing out and then detached the entire parachute canopy from the container. So let me describe this as best I can. Inside the container at the back of it, the part that would be facing your chest if you were wearing this as a reserve chute, right? There are two metal rings that connect directly to the rings on the other side that are connected to your harness, right? And then there's this thing called a cross connector, which is basically a very long piece of parachute cord that's been wound through those two rings, back and forth and back and forth and back and forth, and then knotted and then bound very tightly. And I showed you a picture of it. You saw the picture, right?
Yeah, I can put this up on some social media.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's just cut.
Yeah.
It's nothing too special.
And so, and then every one of the shrouds, that is the pieces of parachute cord that go from the canopy down to the container, this is what they attach to. They're looped around that and then stitched back upon themselves. And I sent you a picture of that as well, so you can see what those look like. So, one of the thoughts was that he cut all these things away so that he could make room inside this container, possibly to hold the money, the ransom money, inside the container, right?
I think that's a pretty reasonable.
Yeah, well, that would be my first thought too. But here's the thing: he didn't. If he wanted to remove all the shrouds and make room inside that container, the thing to do would have been to cut the cross connector that the shrouds were all looped around, and then just slide them off, remove the entire thing. And he didn't do that. But what he did instead is he cut each one of those loops around the cross connector carefully. He had brought a pocket knife with him. He cut every one of those loops individually, very carefully cut them, and cut the entire parachute and everything and the shrouds away from that cross connector. And then after that, he took two pieces of parachute cord and used those again to secure his money bag. And then he also took three other pieces. We'll talk about that in a few minutes here, but so that's the question: is why did he do that? Why did he cut every loop like that? And actually, that's something at CrimeCon, I was having a chat with Tom Kay about some of the imponderables in this story. And that was one that he brought up himself. He said, for example, he mentioned the whole thing about cutting all the loops and just said, that's just one of those things that nobody knows why the hell he did that. It's just a mystery. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Although I at the time I said to Tom, I said, well, maybe he was OCD. But since then I've had a few days to think about it. I came up with another idea as to maybe why Cooper did that.
I laid on me.
Yeah. Well, here's what I think. I think that he very carefully dissected that chute because he was looking for signs of sabotage. Because that was a real possibility. I mean, I'm looking, if you look at from Cooper's point of view, he gets two parachute sets, one front, one, two front, two back, right? Mm-hmm. But one of the reserve chutes has been stitched shut, is unusable, is clearly labeled as just a training aid and not usable. Mm-hmm. And so if I was Cooper, I would ask myself the question, does that mean they want me to use this other reserve parachute? And if so, mm-hmm. why?
Yeah.
That's what I'd be asking. And so if I had been Cooper, I probably would have opened up at least one parachute and done the same thing. He was probably looking for any spots where they might have cut that cross connector, and so that's my theory on why I think he did that.
Yeah, or possibly he was looking for recording devices or trackers or something. I don't know why he put the knots the way he did, but that maybe he was seeing if there was any wiring hidden in there or something like that.
Mm, yeah, it could have been that too, I guess. A little dead cord, a little bomb, a little altimeter bomb. Maybe that's why he turned away the altimeter triggered chutes from McCord Air Force Base and insisted on ones with rip cords. Maybe that's why.
I thought about that. Too easy to sabotage. Mm-hmm. Too easy to verify if they haven't sabotaged it. And too easy for them to put they didn't really have GPS in 1971, but something in there that they could, a beacon that they could, if they could get close enough to him with an airplane or helicopter, where they'd know his approximate location.
Mm-hmm.
I think that might have been possible back then. And even if it wasn't possible, it might have been possible enough to freak Cooper out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so, he was a careful guy. So, anyway,
know that about him.
Yeah.
All right. So does that move? Where are we at with this now? Are we moving on to the pressure bumps?
Well, no, there's another, this was another puzzle here. And this is something, again, I mentioned it to Tom Kay. I said, and this is about how many pieces of parachute cord did he take out of that parachute?
Right.
And the standard line that you hear is he took two out. And the Wikipedia page, we know Wikipedia is never wrong. And it says that he took two lines out of that parachute. And again, used one to tie up the bag of cash and use the other one to wrap around his waist to create kind of a belt that you could tie the bag to. When you look at, I don't know if you checked out the Citizen Sleuth webpage. That they have.
I've been on there. Actually, if not, I meant to visit it after we went to CooperCon, but I never did.
Yeah. They've got a whole section on the parachute. And so they went through the FBI's records and they found one report that said two individual shroud lines had been cut off from the canopy. And then they found two other transcripts in the FBI archive that said that three of the shroud lines had been cut, which is interesting. Hmm. I mean, but I could see why this might happen because actually the two that he took initially were they were cut, I don't know, about let me think here, over 20 feet away from the canopy. in distance. And the other three were cut much closer to the canopy in distance. And so so it's possible that somebody just saw those two, you know, cut dangly ends out there. So, well, it looks like he took two lines out there. And then somebody else could have been looking around the edge of the canopy at the lines and seen three cut lines, but not have realized those other two lines were cut as well, because they were actually a further away from the canopy. So maybe, anyway. But anyway, and long story short here, it looks like five pieces of parachute cord were taken. Although, you know, again, you know, and the big question here is, well, one of the questions is, of course, how did the FBI manage to screw up? And, you know, one agent looked at it and said two lines were cut. Another one looks and says three lines are cut. The citizen sleuths, when they pulled the parachute out, they did find indeed that five lines had been taken out of the parachute. So, you know, the interesting question is what did he do with those three extra pieces of parachute cord?
Right.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Wow. What did he do? Some people have said that he used them to secure the other reserve parachute to his harness. This is assuming that Cooper is too dumb to notice that his reserve parachute is labeled non-functioning, but oh well. but the other thing about it is he doesn't need, you know, 200 or 300 feet of parachute cord to secure that thing to his harness. I mean,
okay.
One of those pieces of parachute cord would have had more than enough length in it to very stoutly secure that reserve chute to his harness, if that's indeed what he really wanted to do with it.
All right.
But he took three pieces again. That's three pieces, just to allay confusion. He took three pieces beyond the initial two that he needed to secure his money to his person. Right, yeah, so he took three more pieces. And he didn't need those to secure the reserve chute to his harness. So why did he need all that parachute cord?
I don't know. Maybe just thought they could come in useful.
Yeah, maybe he was going camping later in the week, you know, and thought some parachute cord would be handy.
Camping in a couple minutes.
Yeah, well, definitely. That's true. Yeah, depending. Yeah, he might have thought it'd be handy for survival in the wilderness if he wound up out there, maybe. But I don't know.
That's all I can think. I mean, sometimes, especially in the heat of the moment, you think something could be useful, you just take it. Just grab it. Fuck it.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. But my one thought was that he might have used them to facilitate a stealthy exit from the plane. But I was going to talk a little bit about that later.
Okay.
I actually presented this idea to some Cooperites at CooperCon, and it got a polite but skeptical reception. I think you were there. Would you say that's a fair characterization?
I think you got a polite but skeptical reception from me. I was there.
So. Well, I think the using the parachute cord to leave the plane without leaving a pressure bump is eminently feasible. The other half of it, creating the fake pressure bump, might be a little harder. I don't know. But we need to get a 727. We'll have our plea for a GoFundMe to rent us a 727 at the end of the episode.
So here's a question for you. Why did Cooper take the non-functioning reserve parachute?
Yeah.
A lot of people, and I don't mean a small amount of people, have used this for evidence that Cooper was a novice, that he wasn't much of a parachutist.
Yeah, yeah, very true. And yeah, it's definitely a bigger deal than you would think it should be. I don't know. You know, first of all, the idea that he was a novice parachute goes against what Tina Mucklow said, but it also is like crazy. Would you jump out of a jet in the dark on a stormy night if you had only done a few jumps? I mean, that whole idea is just nuts. But nonetheless, a lot of people believe that because he did take the non-functioning reserve parachute. But again, another reason I think, because Tina said that he had no trouble whatsoever putting on the parachute. There was no confusion, no hesitation. But also, you know, if the guy was truly a novice, you'd think he'd be sweating and nervous, you know. And Tina reported he was calm all the way through. So, yeah.
The other thing I would say, though, also, Joe, is that this reserve chute hasn't been recovered.
No, it has not been recovered.
So you can make something of the fact that he didn't go, this doesn't work, take this back and bring me what I asked for. He could have done that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Or he could have decided he had everything he needed to make the jump and was like, I'm not going to mess with these guys.
Yeah.
and, you know, possibly cause the situation to get out of hand. And just because they didn't find it on the plane, people say, oh, he took it with him. Well, do we know that for a fact?
Or could
he, I mean, at any point when they weren't watching, he could have hucked that thing out the back door just to make sure there are no fingerprints on it or whatever.
Yeah. I mean, it's occurred to me, I'll talk a little bit more about my theory about how to create a fake pressure bump to fool people to think he bailed off the plane, but it could have been that. Maybe he needed a little extra weight to help him get the air stairs down and fully deployed and locked. And then he just threw it, pitched it. He threw it away. You know, maybe that's maybe that's it. Because so the fact that it was not on the plane doesn't mean that he took it necessarily. But and I think I mentioned this too. There's that old paratrooper's trick of, of if you're jumping at night, you suspend your pack or something underneath you on a long piece of cord or something, like say 15 or 20 feet below you. So, you know, when you're falling in the darkness underneath your parachute and you're about to hit the ground, that thing hits first, and when you notice that the weight is gone off your that line, you know you're about to hit, you're about to touch ground, you know. So maybe he used it for that,
maybe,
which would indicate again that he's not a novice. Actually, he maybe even had some paratrooper experience.
I kind of feel like he must have, because even if he'd only been a few times, like let's say that you go to jump school for, you know, guys who like to do this, which is much less common back in the 60s and early 70s. Mm-hmm. But let's just say you want to get into that. So you go to a place, they take you up in the airplane, jump out of the airplane. Yeah, you could do that, but it would be cost prohibitive, you know, even back then, to do that enough times that you could just whip on a harness like that, especially because they're kind of weird harnesses. They're not what you would probably be getting if you were at a jump school.
Yeah, no, they're different. Actually, there was some discussion about the strange system that these parachutes used to and how it was flummoxing even for people who were experienced jumpers if they had never used them before. And so, and apparently Cooper, again, put it on with confidence and ease.
And that says to me that he's a guy who's, well, at the very least, put on the things a bunch.
Yeah. So I think he did have some military experience. Although, again, maybe not. I mean, these things did go into, a lot of them were sold on the civilian market as military surplus. So it could be that he was part of a skydivers club and they actually had, maybe he actually owned one of these things. I mean, so that's possible too.
That is possible. Then he just got lucky though, because he didn't. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, he didn't specifically request this Navy grade parachute.
No, he didn't. Right? He did not. So again, he just seemed to be quite able to understand and use whatever they threw at him. And again, and the way he disassembled that reserve chute so carefully, I mean, again, suggests to me that he understands how he understood how these things worked.
I think people who say that the fact that he accepted this bunk reserve chute, I don't think that they've laid out a good case that he was an incompetent paratrooper.
No, I think he just decided to let it slide because he wanted to get the show on the road.
Needed to get the show on the road. Yeah. I think they underestimate how intense a situation that must have been sitting on the tarmac at SeaTac.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. No, the longer he's sitting on the tarmac, the longer they have to sneak a SWAT team out there or something like that. And,
anything.
Yeah.
Anything.
And so, yeah.
Disable the plane. Who knows what they're going to do?
Yeah. So, yeah. That's one of my theories as to why he asked for $200,000. You know, I mean, why didn't he ask for $500,000? I mean, Richard McCoy, only months later, the hijacked a 727 and demanded $500,000, and he got it.
Yep.
And so, why did he ask for only $200,000? You know.
Yeah. So we can talk about that. That's one of my theories. It's just a question. It's not even a theory. He either got lucky, or that, you know, because this bank in Seattle, because I looked into this a while ago because I didn't understand it. This bank in Seattle had $200,000, had more than $200,000, I don't know how much they had, but more than $200,000 in money around in non-sequential bills.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right. Now, they'd photocopied all the serial numbers so they could get them back, but there's a limit to how many non-sequential bills you're going to find anywhere. And so I always wonder if maybe he had some knowledge of about the banking system.
Yeah.
If he had some knowledge about how far he could push his ass.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. The it was like SeaFirst Bank, I believe, in Seattle, and they were.
I think you're right. Yeah.
And they were picked actually. They were the first go-to bank because they actually had a little branch office in the airline terminal in Seattle. And so they the Northwest Airlines guys went first to them. And they contacted the home office in downtown and who confirmed that, yeah, they did have a couple hundred thousand laying around just waiting to be used for this very thing. And yeah, it is when that's occurred to me too, is that how did he know that these people would mm-hmm. have a couple hundred grand laying around?
Yeah.
But of course, we don't know. I mean, maybe they had half a million in a pile of half a million 20s yeah, laying
I've
around.
Never
I don't
heard
know
them say but, exactly how much that stash was.
Yeah. I don't know. So. But right. I mean, that's, and so, yeah, it could have been some sort of insidey kind of job. Doesn't mean he worked at that bank. Maybe he knew somebody who did, and that person just sort of carelessly talking in a bar one night said, "Yo, yeah, they got this pile of cash just waiting for a hijacking or whatever, $200,000 mm-hmm. sitting down there in the vault, you know, and maybe something like that." Yeah. But anyway, how did we get off on this? We were talking about the non-functioning reserve sheet. But yeah, I think that getting back to that briefly, yeah, he did. I think a lot of stuff indicates to me that he wanted this whole thing to go smoothly and quickly. So he didn't argue about the reserve sheet and didn't ask for vast amounts of money. So okay, but other than that, I don't know. I think we solved the issue of the non-functioning reserve sheet. He didn't take it.
Yeah, I think so too.
Yeah. Yeah. The pressure bump is actually is something that if you're going to be a Cooperologist, you have to know all about this, right? Don't you think?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
So let me give you a quick rundown of how the pressure bump affects this.
Yeah.
When Cooper deployed the air stairs in mid flight, right? So you remember the 727 has a set of stairs that can descend off the back of it.
Yeah.
The plane was traveling about 170 knots. That's like 195 miles an hour.
Yeah.
The airflow itself would have, apparently, I honestly don't know enough about them, but you do.
No.
The airflow would have prevented the stairs from lowering very far, but Cooper's weight could have caused the stairs to extend downward.
Yeah.
When he jumped off, yeah?
No, I was going to say, they did. I mean, because the FBI actually pushed a sled loaded with sandbags out, you know, the following week out of the back of that exact same plane.
Right.
And that did, and that weight did, was enough to push the stairs pretty much all the way down. They had a film, a little, so they were filming from a chase plane.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. So, yeah. So basically he jumps off the stairs and they snap back.
Yeah. The wind pushes him back up hard, right? Mm-hmm. It's just like if you push the door of your car open on the freeway at 60 miles an hour and then you let it go, it's going to slam shut, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Hopefully anyway.
This created oscillations in cabin pressure.
Yeah.
Cause the crew noted that they probably could feel is how Rick Meltzer talked about it.
Yeah. They felt in their eardrums and they reported that about 8:12. It happened a few minutes before. It took them a few minutes to report it, but okay. Yeah. So yeah, that's the pressure.
Yeah. Bump. So this is a big deal because this is, the pressure bump is where the FBI points out that they think Cooper jumped. I think they're pretty reasonable in this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Other people don't. Joe will talk at length about how it could have happened elsewhere, and we're going to in just a second.
But it's totally reasonable to presume that he jumped out there. I agree. I totally agree.
Not even there. It's at that time.
Yeah.
I think something was going on at 8:12.
Yeah.
That probably, almost certainly, was Cooper jumping out of the airplane. Yeah. Where they were at 8:12, I'm less sold on. But
well, that's why the jump zone
would have been the kind of thing you noticed.
That's why the jump zone is so large, because there is some uncertainty as exactly where the plane was. But on top of that, there's uncertainty about precisely how strong crosswinds were that would have pushed him around once he deployed a chute, and which direction the winds were blowing, and also uncertainty about when he would have deployed his parachute, because, you know, if he deployed it right away, that means he drifts further to the northeast from the jump spot. If he free falls the long distance, then he doesn't go as far north, right? And for his landing. So,
yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So that causes a very large jump zone, which, by the way, if you want to be a Cooper aficionado, take it from me, don't pay too much attention to the jump zone, because it's a pretty vast area. A lot of it's been searched. Not a hint of a clue has been found about Cooper in any of that space. Mm-hmm. Which doesn't prove that he didn't land there, because it's a pretty huge space. I mean, it'd be very easy to lose your stuff in that space.
Mm-hmm.
But that is, so that is the pressure bump, and that is why the landing zone as defined by the FBI and is what it is. Although I think that there is a possibility, as you mentioned, Vincent, that he could have jumped out further south. Maybe. A lot of people don't believe this, but yeah.
All right. Well, do you want to talk about Nicky now?
Well, yeah, Nicky Broughton, for example, Nicholas, full name Nicholas, that's his formal name. But he's put together a theory that D.B. Cooper was James Klansnik, who was a former Boeing engineer, and that Klansnik actually bailed around Cottage Grove, Oregon, which is south of Eugene, not too far. And his theory does not get a lot of respect from Cooperologists because it just isn't possible. Cooper jumped out over southwest Washington, right? 140 miles north of Cottage Grove, right? Yeah. But, well, you know, even though I think it's unlikely that he bailed up further south, I think it actually was theoretically possible that he did. And, you know, people say, no, he couldn't have done that because he would have left another pressure bump when he jumped out the back of that plane.
Now, one, I think that's,
one theory that people have come up with is that he avoided the pressure bump by, and I think this was like the Barb Dayton theory. Barb Dayton supposedly bailed out also over the Willamette Valley, according to popular story. Yeah. And Barb did this apparently by sort of laying down on the stairs, head towards the back of the plane, pulling the parachute out of the container and sort of like pushing it down the stairs and out of the plane until the wind caught it and then basically dragged Barb out the back of the plane.
Yeah. That's a way to bail out. She wouldn't be the first person to try that.
Yeah. And so
I still think it caused pressure bumps, but
I don't think it would actually. I mean, if you're pulled out the stairs without putting much of your weight on the stairs and the stairs won't go down and they won't come bouncing back up and create these pressure fluctuations. Now, the problem I have with that theory is, I guess that part of it depends on how far down the stairs you would have to go to lay there and, you know, and deploy your parachute and have it pull you out the back of the plane. Because obviously the further out you go, the more you are going to push those stairs down. So how easy would it be? Because you'd have to be basically laying at the top of the air stairs, which is quite a distance from the bottom of the air stairs, which is where your parachute kind of needs to go to catch the wind, right? So that seems to me like it'd be a tricky maneuver to, I don't know how you pull that whole maneuver off exactly.
I don't know either. Yeah. The whole thing sounds a little crazy. Now I will say for Nicholas's theory, he claims, I haven't really had the time to fact check this. I mean, I just haven't gotten around to it.
Yeah.
But he claims that somebody was flying over Cottage Grove dropping flares as possibly a test run just the night before. Yeah. So that's kind of interesting.
That is kind of interesting. And
So not everybody, Joe and I are Oregonians. We have to be careful about this.
Yeah.
Cottage Grove is a really long way from Ariel, Washington.
It is. It is quite a long ways. But it's actually within the Victor 23 flight path. How far is Cottage Grove from I-5, actually?
It's just off I-5. It's not,
and which is
super far. You do have to leave I-5 to get to it.
Yeah, I know. It's since basically the Victor 23 air path or, you know, whatever air route is defined more or less by I-5, then the Cooper's plane did fly over that area. But as far as like dropping flares, I don't know. I mean, I'm not sure exactly. If somebody was doing preparation for Cooper's bailout, what precisely was accomplished by dropping flares out of a plane? I'm not really sure about that, but, I
think the theory would go something like this, Joe, that the bomb wasn't a bomb. It was a bunch of flares. Yeah. And so when he had the flight crew all, you know, up in first class or up in the pilot's quarters, the cockpit, I believe is what they call those.
Yeah. The flight deck.
He went out to the flight deck. Yeah. Thank you. He went out on the air stairs and started dropping flares to alert whoever was to find him.
Mm-hmm.
And so basically took apart his bomb and started throwing the flares out, and that the experiment in Cottage Grove would have been a test run. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying I embrace this theory, but I think that's how the theory goes.
Yeah. Yeah. And it definitely, I mean, it would make sense at least to maybe hang on to one flare. And as you parachute down, light that flare so whoever is waiting for you on the ground can see where you're coming down and try and, you know, get in the car and drive towards you to pick you up, maybe.
Yeah, that would be dicey, but you could try it.
Yeah.
It depends on the kind of flare you have.
Yeah, the problem is road flare. Yeah, well, there's that.
A boat flare would burn you.
Yeah, that's possible as well. And also, of course, you might attract the wrong sort of attention, too. Because a law enforcement officer might see that and say, oh, my God, what's that? I better go check that out. You know. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. I mean, it doesn't really make sense to me.
I'd have to talk to Nicholas Moore to really get my brain around what he's thinking. Mm-hmm. I have not really fully looked into his suspect or his case, but
I have not either, actually, although I did chat with Darren Schaefer from the Cooper Vortex podcast about it. And he said, you know, that he thinks that James Klansnik is actually a really interesting suspect. I mean, he seems pretty intrigued by Klansnik. But like most Cooperologists, he just has a problem with the idea that he bailed out further south, which is that's why I wanted to talk about my idea for how Cooper could have actually bailed out of the plane and not done the radical barb method, which I think that the Barb Dayton method sounds like a way to break some bones.
I'd have to see it. Like, you know, just talking about it isn't, or even just reading about it isn't good enough for me. I have to see some illustrations. It sounds crazy.
If the stairs are not very far down, you've got a pretty small opening to get out of, and
that's what I'm saying.
And there is there is that bottom of the plane right there, that curved bottom of the plane that your head could very well smash into as you're being pulled out at high speed by your parachute. So it just sounds to me like a really dangerous maneuver.
Yeah. Sorry, do you want to talk about your theory? Well,
I took a good look at the air stairs and how they worked, and bearing in mind also that Cooper inexplicably took a few extra pieces of parachute cord with him.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out I'm going to describe, this is hard to describe. Maybe what I'll have to do is do a little YouTube presentation or something like that for our listeners. But essentially, the air stairs are raised and lowered by these two tubes that connect to the stairs themselves near the bottom. And those are connected at a hinge point above to a yoke that is basically like a U-shaped yoke. It's like a square U. So there's a horizontal piece and then two arms that come down and connect to the ends of those arms. Okay. And that connect to the air stairs. So, for example, when the plane is on the ground and those stairs are down, then the two upper arms and the lower arms kind of form a straight line downward. And then when you want to raise the stairs, there's a lever at the top that you pull towards the front of the plane, and that will raise them by hydraulics. So what that is those two upper arms are rotated by hydraulics up towards the front of the plane, pulling those two lower arms up and pulling the stairs with, right? Now at the back of the, when the stairs are fully closed, those arms, the upper arms are pointed more or less straight towards the front of the plane. And if the stairs are partially deployed, they're going to be pointing more or less towards the front of the plane, but a little bit down. So what I was thinking you could do if you wanted to hop off those stairs without leaving a pressure bump, all you got to do is just get to the end of those and get off of those without pushing them down very far. You push them down a little bit. You just don't want to push them down as far as your 200 or 230 pounds of weight is going to push them down. And so the way to stop them from going down is there is a railing that's on both sides there of the stairs. It's a cast aluminum piece, and there's four bolts that come out of it that are set into it. And those bolts go into the bulkhead there. And I've seen the bulkhead, by the way. I don't know if I mentioned that I got an assist in this from Bruce Campbell. Did I mention that last week? I can't remember.
You did mention that.
Okay, yeah. So I looked at Bruce Campbell's 727, and he had for a while, he's got some photos. He had some of the bulkhead covering removed, and you can see the framework underneath. So those bolts from the railing there go into this framework, and that's part of the supporting framework of that whole space back there. And so the whole thing, it's a very strong railing if you just basically tied a loop of parachute cord around the top bolt on that railing, loop it around the joint between the upper and lower arms on the air stairs, and tie it with a knot. Maybe a slip knot, exactly, if you want to be sneaky and take the parachute cord with you and not leave evidence of what you've done. You tie that around, then you can go out to the end of those air stairs without pushing the stairs down. And you can bail off the plane without leaving a pressure bump. Now,
the only problem I have with your theory is that it puts DB or whoever in the mindset that pressure bumps are really going to matter.
Yeah, here. I know. That's the question. There's a couple of things there. Number one, there's no evidence that Cooper did this. Number one, and number two, it doesn't move us any further down the road towards solving the mystery. And number three, like you said, was Cooper really aware that him jumping off the plane would leave such a detectable signature? Was he really aware of that? I don't know. I mean, I just don't.
Right. And that would be a huge part of how you do the, yeah, I just don't think that would have happened like that, but that's my,
yeah. I really don't know. I don't know how much experience he had. I mean, there were people that, in Southeast Asia during the Vietnam War, we were introducing commandos and air supplies, et cetera, into Laos, for example, and Cambodia, using 727s, you know, commandos, right. Commandos jumping out the back of the plane and, you know, and pushing supplies out the back of the plane and stuff. So if Kiepert had a job like that, he might have well been aware of what happens when people jump out the back of the 727. And so maybe, you know, he could have been aware of the pressure bump phenomenon, but I don't know. I mean, I truly don't. I mean, but the whole point I'm making here is not that this proves that he did this. It's just that it's theoretically possible that Kiepert could have hopped out of that plane further south and not left a pressure bump. And yeah. So the only reason I'm pushing that idea is just I don't want theories like, say, Nicky Broughton's theory to be dismissed out of hand just because people think it's fair not enough. Possible that he jumped out that far south. I think it is possible. I think it's possible. Well, you saw my presentation. You got to admit, I totally agree that we're again not going to really know 100% for sure if my technique would work until we get our hands on a 727. So
go to Joe's Kickstarter.
I think it'd be great. I haven't flown in a 727 in years. I think it'd be fun.
Yeah,
it'd be very nostalgic. So
I'll have you jump out.
Yeah.
Hey Joe, we got to do a quick commercial break.
Oh no, that's a good idea.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let's do a quick one, then we'll be back to talk about a few more things.
You've worked hard for what you have, your money, your assets, your 401k, and home. Isn't it all worth protecting? Nearly one in four consumers have been a victim of identity theft. LifeLock Ultimate Plus helps protect your finances with up to $3 million in reimbursement. LifeLock alerts you to identity threats you might miss. And if your identity is stolen, your dedicated U.S.-based restoration specialist will work to fix it. Let LifeLock help protect what you've worked so hard for. Save 25% off your first year on LifeLock Ultimate Plus at LifeLock.com/aware. Terms apply.
And we're back from the commercial. Hope you enjoyed that. So our next topic, what do you want to do for our next topic, Vincent? You got any ideas?
I think we got to talk about the hit Sarah Michelle Gellar film, The Grudge.
The Grudge. Oh, yeah. I never saw that, to be honest with you. I hate to admit that.
It's a remake of it. No, we're talking about D.B. Cooper's Grudge, not Sarah Michelle's Grudge.
Yeah, we talked about that a little bit last week when Tina Mucklow said, do you have something against Northwest Airlines, mister? And Cooper says, I don't have anything against your airline, miss. I just have a grudge. The Grudge, the famous Grudge. And it's just almost anybody that comes out with a new D.B. Cooper suspect feels obliged to tell us what this particular person's grudge was.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I don't know.
I guess we can run through it. My take on this is that if I was talking to somebody and I didn't want to give them a straight answer about anything that maybe could get back to me or whatever, even if I was just distracted by everything going on, they're like, do you have a grudge against Northwest Airlines? Be like, I got a grudge.
Yeah. Well, that's true. The grudge might have had nothing to do with this. His grudge might have been against his first grade teacher, you know, who smacked him on the wrist or something unjustly.
Yeah, who knows?
Yeah. I mean, but there's I think one of the earliest and most famous potential grudges, and the grudge is important in the sense that if you find out specifically what the grudge is, it could just lead you to Cooper. But of course, you're not going to find out what the grudge is until you find Cooper. It's a conundrum, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, exactly.
But so one of the potential grudges was that this was right around the time that Boeing was downsizing, and they had laid off thousands of employees, and so some people thought, well, maybe he was an embittered Boeing employee.
See, I always love this, but I can never get it to connect.
Yeah.
So your boss lays you off from the factory where they make airplanes.
Yeah.
So you hijack an airplane, and that Like, he didn't get back at Boeing.
No, not at all. Like you get laid up from the Nissan factory, so you go rob a bank using a Nissan as a getaway car. Wow, you really showed Nissan, didn't you?
Yeah, right. It doesn't. I don't. Yeah, exactly. It doesn't. It like it show nearly makes sense. Oh, they took his job. They took his dignity. He knew the airplane, so he'd have the skills to know about air stairs and pressure bumps. So he got back at him. But the ransom didn't come from Boeing.
No,
I don't think it even made hardly a dent in air travel. Certainly, no one was like, "Well, I'm going to get on a Northrop Grumman plane because I don't trust those Boeing planes because it got skyjacked." That never happened. Mm-hmm. It doesn't quite line up. It doesn't quite make sense.
Doesn't do anything to hurt Boeing at all. But you know. But let's move on to our next one. This is a more recent one. The William Smith theory that some people have put him forth as a potential suspect, and he worked at a railroad for years, and they thought that perhaps his grudge was that he was embittered because these smart ass upstart airlines were taking away railroad's travel business. Maybe. I don't know. That's even worse than the Boeing thing, actually. Any others that you can think of? Any others that are out there that are famous?
Well, so not really.
No. Yeah.
I think there's this whole idea. There's a suspect who was a trans woman.
Oh, yeah.
And people felt that Barb Dayton felt that, you know, Barb didn't have a grudge against Northwest Airlines or Boeing, just kind of a grudge against the world for being born in a body that, you know, that she didn't feel at home in or something like that.
Yeah.
That all kind of makes sense, but I'm going to need more than that to think that's a viable suspect, which there is more, but
I don't know. You don't need to hijack a plane if you're bitter for being born in the wrong body. Just go rob a bank or something, you know, or
do anything else. Know. Yeah,
drive your car through a kid's birthday party. I don't know. There's all kinds of ways to get back at the world. I don't know.
Don't do that last one.
Seriously, don't.
Yeah, it's kind of an odd way to get back at society. It like you can say it sort of makes sense in a way. You could see, you know, because this is 1971, right? You could see a trans person in 1971 having a chip on their shoulder, feeling a grudge against society, against the world, against biology, against all these factors.
Yeah, sure. But
so with a lot of people, right? If you're going that general with it, I mean, pick somebody, right? Yeah. Any queer person, any person of color, anybody who had been laid off from their job at Boeing.
There's a lot of people out there with a chip on their shoulder and a grievance, you know? So, well, one of the thoughts that I have had is that maybe his grudge was against the Globe Indemnity Company.
This one is the one that goes basically that they were the insurer of the air flight.
Yeah.
Of the airline, sorry, that whose flight it was.
Yeah.
And that they had a blanket crime policy covering losses up to $250,000.
Yeah. Yeah, for crimes. So just for some criminal act that takes place, you know, in or on Northwest Airlines, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so, it makes me wonder if perhaps maybe they once denied a claim for $200,000, you know?
Yeah, or something. Yeah.
Or maybe $50,000 and Cooper was adjusting for inflation. Maybe it was, you know, a while back. I don't know.
Yeah. I guess the only problem I have with that, it's an interesting theory, but the only problem I have with that is if I really wanted to do some damage, I would have maxed out the claim.
That's true.
I would ask for at least $250,000.
That's true. That's a good point. Why didn't he max out the claim? And also it's possible maybe he was a former employee of Globe Indemnity, because actually how many people are going to know that Globe Indemnity is Northwest Airlines insurer and that they have a crime policy? How many people would know that, you know?
I want to take this though opportunity to put out, it's not a theory, well, it's sort of a theory, it's not a suspect, but every time we saw a picture of D.B. Cooper growing up, my grandfather would swear, "I know that guy. I didn't know him personally.
Yeah.
I used to see him on that flight, the Victor 23 flight that runs between Portland and Seattle.
Mm-hmm.
And I recognize him. I recognize his suit. I know that guy he was really sure he was a businessman who frequently had to air commute between Portland and Seattle.
Did he look like an insurance executive?
Well, my grandfather was in insurance.
Oh.
And so, yes, he did.
Oh, whoa. Your grandpa was D.B. Cooper. Oh, my God.
I'll show you a photo of my grandfather, and you will immediately not think that.
Oh, really?
Okay.
All right.
Two men of about the same age have probably never looked more different without having a I don't know, some sort of distinguishing feature of some kind.
Okay.
They're pretty different looking guys.
That would be fascinating, though, if your grandpa did actually see Cooper. Maybe he did. I don't know.
He was sure of it. He's like, he just was one of those guys that I would never talk to, but that I'd see on that flight.
Mm-hmm.
And what do we make of that? I don't know. Maybe Cooper was casing the flight, and so he took it a bunch and did run into my grandfather. Maybe my grandfather's crazy. Maybe part of why we even talk about this case at all is because that sketch of D.B. Cooper is relatively anonymous and can be almost anyone.
Yeah, that's the problem with most of these police sketches is that, you know, that it's really hard sometimes to see to really definitively identify somebody from some one of those things unless there's some unless they've got, you know, some helpful big ugly birthmark right on their face. That's kind of cool.
Yeah, scar. Yeah. Yeah, Cooper just. I think there were so many people in the world who could have been D.B. Cooper.
Oh yeah, no, definitely.
All right. So,
and of course, another one I think is a possible grudge would be that Cooper or maybe a family member was the victim of a skyjacking, because skyjacking in those days was really common, disturbingly common.
Yeah, you know, sure.
It really was. And only a year before, I'm not going to go into great detail about this, but one of the most spectacular hijackings of all time up till 9/11, probably the most spectacular one up to that point, was the Dawson Field hijackings, which involved the hijackings of 5 airliners, the destruction of those airliners, holding a huge number of people hostage for weeks, touched off the Jordanian Civil War,
yeah.
Led to acts of terrorism for years afterwards. And so that was only a year before. And so that would be actually a great source of a grudge, I think. If Cooper had been one of those hostages, that would have been, that would be a great grudge. Although again,
that would have been cool, but
again, I don't know. I mean, and maybe he was angry with the airlines because they were so damn careless about letting people onto the planes without checking them for weapons and explosives and stuff. So maybe he was angry and just thought, well, I'm just going to like, you know, cost him. I'm going to take a couple $100,000 out of their pocket as you know, payment for my troubles of being, you know, held.
We've got to be moving on, but I do need to slow us down even more with my one theory that I've thought about for a long time that dovetails with what you're talking about.
Yeah.
The concept of skyjacking didn't really exist in the early days of commercial airlines, right? Yeah. But by the end of the 60s, this was something that was happening and seemed to be on the rise.
Yeah.
Maybe somebody, I don't know, the FBI or the TSA staged this whole thing to get people more paranoid about airport security and the potential for skyjacking before some PLA guys did it or, you know, something like that.
Yeah, no, there is actually, that's been discussed. This at this time,
God,
this
damn, was, I didn't think of that one all on my own.
Well, I mean, great minds think alike, you know, but it has been mentioned before, like the Nixon administration at that time was like, you know, I've been hearing a lot from a lot of different people about leading on the airlines to start using better security and screening procedures and stuff, but they were reluctant to do so because some of these airline exec types were big donors, political donors. Oh. They didn't want to offend their donors. If you want that, and so that kind of makes sense, you know, if you want to put some pressure and you can just say to your donors, hey, what can I say? This thing has got people up in arms. We have to do something. Sorry, man. Don't be mad at me. You know, so yeah. There's that theory that's been put out there that perhaps this was kind of a black flag operation, which
well, that gets you two things. It explains why the money was never recovered and why nobody got hurt, really.
That could explain. Yeah, it could explain why it went off so smoothly. I mean, maybe there was even a co-conspirator up in the flight deck, you know, the pilot, the co-pilot, maybe.
It could also
explain his choice of name, Dan Cooper. What are Dan Cooper's initials?
DC.
Yeah. There you go.
Like District of Columbia.
Yeah. So anyway, that's another theory that's out there and I like it. You know, it's fun. It's cool. Maybe, you know, let's get,
yeah.
And actually that would explain the disappearance of the cigarette bus. Don't you think?
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, that's kind of why I always wonder when exactly I got to do more reading on this, but I just don't have time to go through the whole 302's dump on Citizen Sleuths or wherever they have that now. Mm-hmm. But, I'd love to know when they lost it, because I think if there was some kind of conspiracy or cover up, the date they lost the cigarette butts may be the crack in the case.
Well, the actual lost date was shortly after the hijacking. The as reported in their records, But gotcha. That doesn't mean they actually were lost on that date. But yeah, apparently Las Vegas FBI went up to Reno and actually did the crime scene, the whole crime scene analysis and all that stuff, right? And so they had the cigarette butts and they sent them to Quantico for scientific analysis and all that stuff to, you know, whatever they were doing back in those days. Like, I'm sure saliva, try to get a blood type, things like that. Maybe lift a fingerprint or two. They sent them to Quantico. Quantico shipped them back to Vegas. They said, but then Vegas was supposed to send them to Seattle and they claimed that they did, but Seattle says, no, we never did. We never got them. It appears they disappeared shortly after the hijacking, but for all we know, they were actually sitting in the evidence in Seattle for years. And then somebody disappeared them and backdated some memos to make it appear that it happened. It happened back in 1971 or two.
Right.
You know? Right. Yeah. I don't know.
Right. Okay.
I really want to get onto the money before we get too long.
Yeah. There's nothing to back that up. I think it's interesting to picture in your brain, but I don't really think that.
No.
I do really want to talk before we run too long about the money, because this is where my brain always focuses. I'm always more interested in this pile of bills on Tina Barr than I am in D.B. Cooper.
This is the big mystery and the big mystery. Yeah. The money find. So do you want to describe the money find?
Sure. So, I mean, we did talk about it last week, but on February 10th, 1980, I don't know who goes to the beach in the middle of February in this.
In the Northwest, you know, when you have a break in the rain and you might in the winter even have a somewhat sunny, decent day, it happens. And people
got to make the most of it.
Yeah, people do make the most of it.
It's true.
Yeah.
And they did have a little kid. And sometimes, like, winter can be miserable with your kid. Uh-huh. It's like running around, tearing up past your car. You get a break in the rain and you're like, go, let's go to the beach, go run around.
Yeah.
So I could see that. Anyway. So this family, the Ingrams, are hanging out at the beach at Tina Barr, which is on the Columbia River. It's just west of Vancouver.
By the way, T-E-N-A, not T-I-N-A. Yes. It's spelled T-E-N-A. Yeah. Just so you know. Yeah.
Yep. Well, because you will hear people say like Tina Barr or something.
That's pronounced Tina Barr as well, but most people call it Tina, so whatever.
Yeah. I've always heard it as Tina from people who live around there.
Yeah.
But anyway.
Good enough for me.
So. Yeah. The little munchkin is digging around in the sand and he finds three packets of money, $2,000 each.
Yeah, 100 bills in each one. Ooh. Mm-hmm. And as we mentioned, I think last week, it caused the birth of the Washougal washdown theory.
Which neither of us are into.
No, yeah, not really. Which is a really tortured way to account for the presence of the money on the bar, on Tina Barr. And then, there was another theory that was put forth that Cooper actually came down in the Lewis River. The money was swept out to the Columbia River and then was possibly snagged by a ship going upstream, you know, and it fell off the ship right around Tina Barr. Again, pretty tortured, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then, of course, Eric Ulis and a few others have postulated that the Flight 305 was actually off course about 4 or 5 miles to the west, and Cooper actually landed on Tina Barr. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. I've heard this too. Yeah. And I don't know. I mean, another theory that I don't really embrace, but I think is worth talking about that I don't see listed here is that the Ingrams put it there.
Yeah. Yeah. They were in cahoots with Cooper. Maybe.
I've heard that more that maybe, I forget the guy's name, but Brian Ingram's father had actually maybe even found Cooper or found Cooper's money or somebody knew had, and they wanted to test what would happen if they took it somewhere, they find it up in Ariel, Washington. Mm. So they take it somewhere and they call the cops and be like, yeah, my kid found some money in the sand. What do you think that's about? And if the first thing back is they go, oh, look at those cereals, that's D.B. Cooper's money, then you know you got to get rid of the rest of it or something.
Yeah.
I don't really embrace this theory, but I thought I'd mention it.
Yeah, no, people have put that forward. I don't agree. I agree with you. I don't embrace it either. I think the thing to do is to probably the best thing to do is to go pass a few of the bills at, like, say, a convenience store, and then just sort of surveil the convenience store and see if the Secret Service and the FBI show up. You know, maybe that's a way to do it. I don't know. I mean, just pass a few bills and just, I mean, if nothing else, I mean, Cooper was a big story. And if you passed a few bills and law enforcement put out the word that these bills had been, had been spent, then, then you know that the money is still pretty hot and you can't just spend it.
Yeah.
You know, that would have been a more logical way to do it than leaving three packets of bills. And again, and why three packets of bills? I mean, if you want to see what the reaction is going to be, one pack would have been just fine. You know,
one pack will be sufficient. Yeah. I have no idea. And I mean, even if there was something to this, which I don't think there is,
no.
We still probably wouldn't have that answer. They may not have been acting rationally. So, okay. So let's move on from the Ingrams because I don't think they did anything at all like that. And
yeah.
I even kind of don't like talking about it.
Yeah. Well,
but
yeah. And so we got this question of a lot of people are coming up with all sorts of tortured explanations for how the money got there.
Going, yeah. I mean, even honestly, the fairly, you know, most people who are skeptical, they believe D.B. Cooper died. Their explanation is going to be something like the Washougal washdown theory.
Yeah.
And the more you talk to them, the more you realize, like we said last week, you haven't been up there.
No.
You don't know this country.
Yeah, exactly.
It sounds really reasonable until you go look at and see how many snags, how many eddies, how much area, how much room there is for that stuff to get hung up on something diverted downstream. Because it's also, remember, it's not just the Washougal itself. It would have had to come down a tributary.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, from the Washougal, it would have come down the Columbia. Which, and by the way, the Columbia has got lots of snags on the bottom of it. If you look underneath any of the rivers around here or anywhere else, there's dead trees and stuff like that. But the other thing about it, you know, that the real killer too, is that the money was actually found on a fairly high spot in the sand that actually would not have been flooded. You know, there was so to me, the people are asking the wrong question. The question is not how the money got there. The question I think is why. Mm-hmm. Why? Because I think, you know, it's pretty obvious to me that either Cooper or somebody who knew him put the money there. And they put it to be found. We don't know precisely what. And so the question is, why did Cooper want this money to be found? And I can think of a couple of different, you know, conjectures.
Write them down.
Well, I think the one possibility is he wanted to send us a message, which is, hey, losers, I'm not dead. Ha ha. Mm-hmm. You know? And
right. The case was maybe slipping from the popular conscience.
Yeah, maybe he just thought it'd be fun to tweak us all, you know, and leave some money. And the way the reason I think he was sending us a message, there's another possibility here too, which is that maybe Cooper decided to leave some money there on Tina Bar where it would be found by someone because he wanted to do kind of what you were talking about with the Ingrams. He wanted somebody to find that money, and hopefully that person would not give it to law enforcement. Hopefully that person would take it and start passing those bills. And then we'll see what the reaction is, right? And if there's no reaction whatsoever, then Cooper might think, hey, maybe it's time for me to start spending my ill-gotten gains.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe.
So that's one possible reason. But, you know, of course, the reason I don't believe that is, I think that's less likely, is that he left three packets of bills, again, and not just one. And he left them sort of stacked on each other. Because the way he left the money there, buried in the sand, three packets of bills stacked crossways on each other, would indicate to me that he wanted to make it abundantly clear that the money could not possibly have gotten there by any kind of natural or random mechanism. And what's amazing to me is that I think that Cooper was unambiguous in his staging of this whole thing. And yet so many people spent so much time assuming that no, the money must have been carried there by the current or by a wild animal. Even though, again, I think Cooper...
the hawk flying through the air was $6,000.
I love it. I think Cooper made it abundantly clear that there's only one way that the money got there, was that somebody put it there, and yet people didn't get it. People were still like, oh, no.
I mean, yeah, I call it, you know, there's a bias that people have. I have a couple different names for it, but that when something becomes the official story, I mean, the official story of the FBI.
Yeah, he was dead.
Is that D.B. Cooper is dead. He bailed out over somewhere near Ariel, Washington. He either no pulled or he did pull and the storm ripped him apart and he dropped to the ground, died there, and no one's come across his body.
Yeah.
We can all talk about how we think that's dumb or not, but for most people, that explanation really is good enough. And I've had people who think that I'm fairly nuts for even suspecting that there's evidence that he survived the jump.
Yeah.
You know, I'm reminded when I'm at somewhere like CooperCon that there are a lot of people who are like, that guy died. He fell off the airplane and died. And you start looking, especially at the money find, you have to admit there's some evidence he made it down.
Yeah, it's unambiguous. I mean, the idea that somebody else found the money and left those bills there makes utterly no sense. It just makes no sense.
I don't know. It's weird. But I do have some questions. Like, you know, you're talking about he would have put it there in the spring, right? And then no one noticed it. Well, one of the other problems I have with it is that if you're saying the money washed down, let's just say the Washougal River can wash down a giant stack of bills, and somehow it can get it up past where recent floods have been. If it was only a couple inches beneath the sand, nobody was kicking sand around on that beach. Chena Bar is a place people go to like swim, and there's boating nearby.
A lot of fishermen go there too. There's all kinds of stuff going on there. Yeah.
Yeah. On a sunny day, even today, you'll see quite a bit of people there. If you talk to people from Vancouver, they know that area. Mm-hmm. It's a swimming hole.
Yeah. And so it's like, it's hard to believe. Well, of course, you don't know how many years it took for the cash to wash downstream and wind up on the beach. If that was true,
I think any amount of time would be really strange for someone not to have eventually started digging around there.
Okay, now, but to me, it's like the idea that Cooper put it there is just pretty much open and shut, simple, easy, Occam's razor stuff. But Tom Kaye did throw kind of a monkey wrench into that with his.
He did. It's pretty weird.
It's interesting. Yeah, he put on a little presentation at KuperCon. Tom has his very own electron microscope, which is kind of cool.
Nice one, too.
Yeah, I know. It's very cool. And he got Mark Meltzer to actually donate a teeny tiny little piece of one of his. Mark Meltzer, Cooper aficionado, actually owns one of the Cooper bills that Brian Ingram found. They were sold at auction. And Mark bought one for like $3,000, I believe.
Yeah, something like that. I forget the
exact. Yeah, he had it at KuperCon. It was on display. I thought it was quite nice of him to bring that down and leave it there for people to look at.
He's a really nice guy.
He is a super nice guy, you know. And I got to say too, for a geezer, and I say that with goodwill and kindness and everything else, because I'm heading towards geezerhood myself. But Mark is, I would say he's well into his 70s.
He
is sharp as a tack. The guy is really smart.
Yeah, he is. Yeah,
yeah, and. But also just a super nice guy. And he brought that thing down there. It's all encased in plexiglass now. And he just left it sitting on a table up by the stage for people to look at.
Trusting.
And yeah, really trusting that nobody would stick it in their pocket and run away with it, you know. But he actually gave Tom Kaye a little teeny piece of that, a very tiny piece to put under his electron microscope. And I think we mentioned the diatoms last week that he found on there. He found some diatoms on there. Most interestingly, if Cooper had gone into the drinks, say, Wall of the West Bay in the Columbia there, and somehow the money winds up on shore, then a certain type of diatom is apparently more prevalent in like the fall and the winter in the water there. The diatom, of course, these are tiny little bits of microscopic algae. And so there's a certain kind that's prevalent in the wintertime and there's a certain type that's more prevalent in the springtime. And the ones that he found on that little chunk of bill were the ones that are the springtime ones. So so if Cooper goes into the drink in late November, then how did the springtime ones wind up there and none of the wintertime ones? Well, if Cooper actually didn't go into the drink, but he just had the money stashed somewhere and he brought out three packets of it and brought them down to the beach and buried them there, then how the hell did those diatoms get on those bills?
Yeah.
It's hard to
get an explanation that covers everything.
Yeah, it is. I mean, I have a few theories about it, but it's entirely conjectural.
I don't know.
So one possibility I thought of is that what if Cooper had dug a hole in the ground, threw the cash in there and covered it over and left it sitting there. And then eventually, years later, 8 years later or whatever, he decides he's going to tweak us all. So he uncovers the cash and takes out three packets of it and brings it down to Chena Bar to bury it in the sand there. And then he realizes, oh, it's got dirt all over it. You know, first, and that might help ID where I live or something like that, because it was buried in my backyard. So I tell you what, I'm going to take it down to the water and whoosh it around in the water and rinse it off really thoroughly before I bury it. So, just purely conjectural, purely speculative.
A possibility. You could also say that he might have been trying to make the money look like it had been out there longer by getting it wet. Mm-hmm. And it's something you can do. I mean, literally, it's something that people do on, for movie sets. You take your fake bills, and if you want them to look old, you can soak them in, you know, water, and sometimes like a dye or whatever. I've done that. So, you know, he might've been trying to make it look, maybe convince them that that had been in the water for a long time. And that's proof that he's dead. So it kind of goes the other way. Instead of tweaking people, he wants them to forget about him. So, he's dead.
Yeah. Maybe that's it. I don't know. But yeah, so the, I like your idea for aging the cache a little bit, you know, and that too would give him a little bit of plausible deniability, maybe. Like, say, if he drove out there and walked out to the beach and buried some money, and then somebody just happens to find it the very next day, and but it hasn't been raining, for example, he could just say, oh, you found packets of soaked, wet dollar bills. Well, I was out there and it wasn't raining and it hasn't rained since. How could I possibly have done it?
You know?
I think the presence of the spring diatoms actually kind of supports the theory again that he planted the money there, because if he had planted it, and supposing he did soak the money for some reason, the time to do that would be springtime, because that's when the use of the beach is going to start heating up. People are going to be going out there and using the beach.
Yeah,
so springtime is the time to go out there and bury your cash. And of course, you know, the public being obtuse like they are, they went out there in great numbers and didn't find the money. Stupid public.
Yeah.
It took until maybe, who knows, the money might have been there a couple of years even. But if he buried him in, say, the spring of 1979, then they weren't uncovered until February 1980. So that's, you know, the better part of a year, the money was just sitting.
Yeah, so 1980. Yeah, he could have left it out there. It's a good point.
Yeah, and so that would actually account for the spring diatoms. So, you know, again, we just don't know why he would have immersed the money in the water. Another theory that I had is that maybe he got to the beach by boat and,
dropped it.
Well, yeah, maybe he got to the beach by boat and he was pretending to be fishing, and maybe he caught a couple of fish or bought a couple of fish and stuck them in one of those mesh bags that you put in the water to, you know, keep your fish cool and fresh by putting them in the water. And he just stuffed the bills in there with the fish maybe and had them dangling off his boat. So the cops showed up and he's got this hot money on him, he can just basically discreetly cut the rope and let the fish and the bills go to the bottom of the river, and that's that, right?
I mean, we could come up with a million.
All kinds of, I know. Anyway, that's about it. That's the money to me is something I can go on about forever, as you could probably tell.
Yeah, I have to reel myself in, because you can conjecture all day
long. Believe me, Vincent and I are not remotely as bad as some of the people you see at KuperCon. Those people can really go on about this stuff forever. And they know a lot more about it.
KuperCon went for 2 days, and I think it could have gone for 2 weeks.
And then it's some of the people that were there have really seriously looked through every freaking FBI document on the case and then looked at all the evidence. I mean, there's people out there that know a lot more than you and I do. But, you know, you and I know enough, I think, to irresponsibly speculate about all kinds of things. And we know enough to solve the case, right? Yeah. Okay, I think that's it for this week, though. I think it's time to stick a fork in this. And so
we may have some bonus content coming for you down the road, but look out for that.
We didn't really get any time to talk about suspects, so we'll drop a little bonus content for you guys about the suspects if you're interested. Again, as usual, stay tuned to hear Tess read you some important information about our email and social media stuff. And of course, as always, you know, please leave us a rating and a review, a good rating and a good review wherever you're downloading this.
It makes such a big difference for us.
Yeah, we like that. We like that. It's a good thing. And of course, if somebody wants to start some sort of a GoFundMe or something to rent a 727, that would be awesome too.
To throw Joe out of.
No. We're going to find a professional to do that part. But anyway, I think it'd be great. I would love to test out my theories about that particular thing. Even though, of course, this is pointless because, in a sense, it doesn't solve the mystery. It's just a fun, to me, I mean, figuring out how Cooper could have bailed out of the plane was just a really fun little puzzle to try to figure out a way that Cooper could have gotten off that plane further south without leaving a pressure bump. So that was kind of cool. That was fun. But does it solve the mystery? No, not remotely. But it's just one more fun thing to think about when it comes to Cooper. But anyway, until next week or until the bonus episode, whichever comes first. Well, I guess, what did Cooper say as he bailed off the plane?
And bye, Geronimo.
Bonsai! okay, next week. Bye.
The Shocking Details can be found at www.theshockingdetails.com. We're on Twitter @ShockingDetails. For discussion of episodes and more, our Facebook group is facebook.com/groups/shockingdetailspodcast/. Or you can email us at theshockingdetailspodcast@gmail.com. And if you like the podcast, please consider giving us a like and a positive review and letting people know about us.
Waiting on a tax return? Hopefully it ends up in your hands. Fraudulent tax returns due to identity theft increased by 30% in 2023. If you're in a bind this tax season, LifeLock can help. Our U.S.-based restoration specialists are experts dedicated to helping solve your identity theft issues. And all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package. So we'll reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. Help protect your information this tax season with LifeLock. Save up to 25% your first year at LifeLock.com/aware.